What's the dish? Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Food Safety Dish, a production brought to you by National Farmers Union's Local Food Safety Collaborative. I'm your host, Catherine Cavanaugh, and today I've got a full table of guests for you. I'm joined by fellow food safety extraordinaires, Billy and Haley, as well as NFU government relations representatives, Mike Strands and Aaron Shire, and finally, Keep Growing Detroit's Akella Karamoko and Ramondo Woods II. In this jam-packed episode, we are digging into the grassroots of advocacy. The word advocacy comes from the Latin advocare, which means to add a voice. Advocacy is all about being an active supporter and a passionate voice for a certain issue. This can range from food safety, urban agriculture, or anything in between or beyond. Oftentimes, advocacy work is done through coalitions or member-based organizations that share a collective mission. And these groups can advance their goals in a variety of ways, whether it being sharing their members' experiences or creating best practices surrounding their focus. On the more technical side, advocacy can include commenting on agency rules and regulations, participating in congressional committee hearings, and creating model nonpartisan legislation. Advocacy can be done directly or in a grassroots fashion. Direct advocacy occurs when leaders or those employed by the organization contact legislators directly. Grassroots initiatives look to group members and the public to get in touch with their legislators or hold events supporting their common cause. Though the results of advocacy are difficult to calculate, grassroots advocacy is generally seen as more effective because legislators want to hear from their constituents. After all, it is their constituents that vote them into office and determine future elections. We can seek to advocate for our communities, whatever scale they may be. Community also comes from the Latin communitas, meaning the same, and further, communis, being public, common, shared by all. When we advocate for our communities, we are giving voice to what we have in common. We can ask questions like, how are the current state of things? What do we need in our community to thrive? What can I communicate to our representative? Is there any legislation that would be beneficial to solving these current problems? Keep this in mind and think how you might be a voice for shared change as we take a look at advocacy organizations, National Farmers Union, and Keep Growing Detroit, and their work for advancing their farm communities. Mike Strands is the Vice President of Advocacy for National Farmers Union and has been in this role since 2020. Strands previously worked on the House Agriculture Committee Democratic staff, most recently as Subcommittee Staff Director for General Farm Commodities and Risk Management. During his 5 years at the Ag Committee, Strands helped negotiate the 2018 Farm Bill and focus on issues related to crop insurance, commodity programs, and grain standards. Before going to Capitol Hill, Strands spent his first 5 years in Washington as a government relations representative at NFU. Prior to that, he worked for Wisconsin Farmers Union as a state lobbyist. Strands earned a bachelor's degree in agricultural journalism from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He grew up on a hobby farm in rural Oconto County, Wisconsin, and served as a state FFA officer. He enjoys organizing marathon walks around D.C., where he lives with his wife, Laura, and 5-month-old son, Peter. Aaron Shire is the Government Relations Director at National Farmers Union. He works to advance Farmers Union members' priorities with policymakers in Washington, D.C., both in Congress and with executive branch agencies. Before joining NFU, Aaron worked on farm and food policy at the Environmental Defense Fund, World Wildlife Fund, and New England Farmers Union. He also spent several years helping manage small farm operations. Aaron completed his undergraduate education at Colgate University, and he earned a Master of Science degree in agriculture, food, and environmental policy from the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. Akella Karamoko is a farmer in Detroit, Michigan. He is a native Detroiter who has always had a green thumb. He planted his first apple tree at 11 years old and sold peppermint and sage at his church when he was 13. Farming as a career path was hardly on the minds of other youth growing up in Detroit, but he sought programs to learn how to plan, grow, harvest, and sell his crops. He's trained in programs like 4-H Gardens, Keep Growing Detroit's Urban Agriculture Youth Apprenticeship Program, Michigan State University's Organic Farmer Training Program, and National Farmers Union's Beginning Farmer Institute. He has worked for the Food Warrior Program with Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and City Foods Good Food Ambassador Program, and is currently working with Keep Growing Detroit as their farm manager. His purpose is to provide similar opportunities for others. He plans to give the next generation the spark to partake in organic agriculture. To reach this goal, he plans to continue pursuing his education in farming, connecting with other farmers, and enjoying the journey and the good food too. Ramondo Woods II is a Detroit native and passionate urban farmer committed to improving opportunities and dietary choices for the youth of Detroit. And he is the visionary founder of Urban Youth Agriculture, or UYA. Ramondo's journey started in 2014 when he co-founded UYA with a mission to address the lack of access to fresh food in Detroit, particularly among the youth. The organization's early days saw a community garden adjacent to a relative's house on Detroit's east side, which quickly grew into a neighborhood garden, providing sustenance for local families. Today, UYA continues to shape agricultural education for Detroit's youth, actively teaching students about growing their own food and other agricultural topics in various schools. The organization also expands its service offerings, including a backyard raised bed garden installations and youth-oriented agricultural events. Under Ramondo's leadership, urban youth agriculture has blossomed into an essential force for positive change in Detroit, empowering the next generation with the tools and knowledge to grow, cook, and eat healthy foods. Welcome to the Food Safety Dish, everyone. It's really great to have you all here today for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Thank you for having us.
Very, very excited to be here.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Let's start with some context on advocacy from the National Farmers Union side. So, Mike, my question to you is, can you give us an overview of how NFU works? We can get a little into the history, and maybe if you could talk a little bit on how it has evolved and stayed the same over time.
Sure. National Farmers Union is a grassroots organization, and that means policy priorities for the organization are set starting at the local level and work their way up through district meetings, through state meetings, and on to the National Farmers Union Convention. So policy ideas that might start up someplace, let's say O'Connell County, Wisconsin, or Dakota County, Minnesota, or Wayne County, Michigan, may well make their way up to a state convention policy discussion and then on to the National Farmers Union policy discussion. And, you know, if you check out the NFU policy document found at nfu.org, you'll see that it's more than 200 pages long and it covers a wide variety of topics. And that reflects the wide variety of farms in the U.S., the wide variety of farmers in the U.S., family farmers and ranchers, and the wide variety of issues we care about. So Farmers Union as an organization certainly cares a lot about farming. Obviously, that's at the core of our organization. But we're also an organization that is about farmers, not farming necessarily. And farmers have a lot of ideas about how communities could be better, how our country could be better, and how the world could be a better place. And that's one of the really cool things about working for National Farmers Union is that you've got a chance to work on issues to help connect people who care about issues with the decision makers who can change those topics through policy changes. And because of that, our grassroots policy process is an extension of the cooperative movement in a lot of ways. So I tie that together because the National Farmers Union got its start with 10 farmers and community members in Texas in 1902, got together because they wanted to have a better way to market their agricultural products. And they didn't want to have to deal with the railroads who were often taking advantage of the farmers or the distributors, the manufacturers. They built power in numbers by working together. Not because they had lots of money, but because they had lots of people behind issues. And that's what Farmers Union is about. One member, one vote, one person, or many people getting together to have a larger voice and building power that way. And that idea, that concept works through all parts of our organization even today.
That's great. Yeah, thanks for sharing. Mike and Aaron, could you give a little bit of an idea of how the government relations team functions at NFU? Maybe share a day in the life of what it's like to lobby for a National Farmers Union?
How about I do the overview? Aaron, you want to do the day in the life? Yeah.
We'll see where it goes. I'll see if I got something to riff off of what you got. But yeah, I've got some thoughts. Go ahead.
With the grassroots policy that National Farmers Union members adopt, we have a staff of about 6 government relations staff members who are dedicated to making sure our voice gets out on Capitol Hill to the administration and to get the word out amongst the general public about how National Farmers Union feels about particular issues, what sorts of solutions we'd like to see, and how to get them done. So largely, our job as National Farmers Union government relations staff is to connect farmers union members with decision makers, with the lawmakers that are going to make those changes. And also to be a kind of a point of contact and a resource for staffers on Capitol Hill or for officials within the administration so that if they have questions about issues that matter to farmers union, we can be trusted subject matter experts and people they can work with to help find some of those solutions. But it might look different on a day-to-day basis, but you know, it's a little different each day. But maybe there's some similarities between all those days too.
That was a really good overview, Mike, of how NFU's government relations team works. And in terms of a day in the life, like Mike said, you know, there kind of is no one day, same day. And I tend to think of our work in terms of 3 main areas and that on any given day we might be working on or working toward. And that's first in terms of our annual policy development process and cycle that kind of happens every year. Because at National Farmers Union, our state divisions, and as Mike mentioned earlier about county and district level policy development, our members are getting together to develop policy. And we steward that process annually and update our national policy annually. So there's sort of an annual cycle that we work on. We also work around the cycle of Congress, which has some annual cycles, such as the annual appropriations process, how you fund the government, but also each Congress lasts 2 years. So we're sort of thinking in terms of those 2-year cycles. We're thinking in terms of election cycles. So we're thinking in terms of those things. And then we're also thinking in terms of who we work with to achieve our goals. And Mike had sort of mentioned how we serve as a resource to members of Congress, you know, having informing those relationships and connections, but also with our members and interfacing with them. And then those are sort of the various things that could result in our day-to-day. And then getting a little bit more into that issue of who we're working with, because I think more than anything, our day-to-day is about the people that we're engaging with. There are sort of 3 buckets. There's the interfacing within the organization, within Farmers Union, with our members, with our state leaders, and all of those sorts of things, providing them feedback about what we're learning and hearing and seeing on the Hill and with the federal agencies we work with stakeholders we work with in DC, and also hearing from them. What are they hearing on the ground? What are, you know, what's going on during this farming season? What economic conditions are they facing? So on and so forth. And then we're also engaging with all of the other stakeholders in DC, whether they're other farm groups or specific commodity groups or other advocacy groups that work on policy issues that are similar to ones we care about, or sometimes on issues we hadn't considered before. And we're thinking about forming or literally working in coalition with those other groups and managing those coalitions, those relationships, and building power together. And then we're also having those interactions with members of Congress and their staff, with staff at, say, USDA or FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, or at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other federal departments and agencies, and building those relationships and helping
educate them about what our members are seeing and hearing and experiencing and what's in our national policy, our grassroots policy that our members have set, and then vice versa, learning from them about what they're facing within the agency that they work in or what, you know, their congressman or woman may be facing or dealing with in a particular committee they're in, and using and harnessing that information for our own advocacy efforts. So no day is exactly the same, but those sort of overriding issues have a big influence on any given day when we're doing our work with our members, with folks on the Hill and in government, or with other stakeholder groups.
Very cool. It sounds like you're kind of like the nucleus. I guess I don't really know how cells work so much, but like receiving information and sending it back out. If that's how it works, I can change this analogy, but.
I don't know. I think we're the mitochondria. I don't know.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. Nice. I don't know my cell biology anymore. I think.
But you do know legislation.
I think mitochondria are like engines or something. Hmm. Yeah.
Very cool. How is the grassroots different from regular advocacy? And could you talk a little bit about how, for example, when the farmers fly in, things like that work, and how that grassroots stuff makes its way all the way from them to the Hill?
I'll take a quick run at that. There are a lot of competing interests in Washington, D.C., and whether those are companies or organizations or individuals or some other institution, there's many people trying to get Congress or the administration to do something or other. In the case of Farmers Union, we're very grassroots grassroots in a different way than a lot of other organizations, because it truly is, you know, we're not there advancing the needs of shareholders or of some big owner or anything like that. We're there advocating for the interests that are, you know, collectively arrived on through our grassroots policy process. We're trying to help out 220,000 plus Farmers Union members, and really all farmers, family farmers and ranchers across the country, through our policy priorities. So that's a different angle. We're not there because of financial clout. We're not there because of the huge political power, because of connections and things like that, although we'd like that, I suppose. But we're there because we're the voice of 220,000 farmers and ranchers from across the country, and that's what sets our grassroots advocacy apart.
Piggybacking on some of what Mike shared, one way we make sure those grassroots voices are being heard directly is every year in mid-September, NFU hosts our annual national legislative fly-in. Fly-in meaning we're flying our members in from all across the country to go up on the Hill and do the kind of stuff Mike and I do when we go lobby. But it is so much more powerful in so many ways when our members are going up there directly and meeting with the members of Congress in the districts they're from, or just to help in a much more direct way, help lawmakers understand what they are experiencing on their farm or ranch or in their community. And so it is important that we take our grassroots policy, and that Mike and I and our colleagues are regularly building and cultivating relationships in Washington, D.C., and making sure the National Farmers Union name is out there and well-known, and that we can serve as a resource. But it's also really important that we're connecting all of those folks we're meeting regularly with our members directly. And we'd do that every month if we could. And some of our state divisions certainly do mini fly-ins, and there are other ways in which we connect our members throughout the year too. But our national fly-in is a big blowout event and opportunity to make sure we've got a large number of our members blanketing the Hill all at once and getting that grassroots message very directly to lawmakers.
Would you say that lawmakers are more receptive to grassroots advocacy, or maybe what are the advantages of it versus non-grassroots advocacy?
I'd probably end up saying something about, you know, all of it needing to work together. I think for the advocacy to be effective, there are lots of different strategies and approaches that should be taken together and that sort of complement each other. And so I think they're all important. And I do, though, think that often, to your question about receptivity, some members will be a lot more receptive, understandably, if hearing that story directly from a member back in their district. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, members of Congress are elected. And so getting those constituents in front of them directly is pretty essential.
That makes sense.
Members of Congress are accountable to their constituents. Mm-hmm. And if we can deliver those constituents to Capitol Hill, sit them down in a member of Congress's office and have that discussion about farmers union priorities, it sinks in a lot better, or oftentimes a lot better than it does if me or Aaron do it.
Right.
Maybe Aaron, it works for him, but not for me.
Yeah. Putting those faces with the names and stories.
And before we move on, I actually did want to speak to what you guys were just saying on how the receptivity matters when it's coming directly from the farmer or the resident in the congressional district at your table now talking to you about issues that, you know, you may or may not be well researched in or well informed about. And so I do applaud the Farmers Union for providing both Akello and I the opportunity to be there in front of our congressional folks and also our senators to really voice ourselves and our issues that we are facing and trying to advocate for on a policy level directly. And it's really rare in a sense of being able to do that and have that capacity to fly folks out directly to speak with their Congress folks. And I think it's very underrated experience that folks, especially farmers, have time to get down there and really advocate for what they're going through. So I applaud you too for the work that you do and getting the farmers that we can down there to really voice themselves.
And I like to add, just on like the personal side, coming from the farmer perspective, like it's as Raimonda was saying, it's a rare opportunity. I had my first time to go out to a fly-in back in 2019 with the Beginner Farmer Institute. And for me, that was my first time doing advocacy, having done it on a state level at that point and really wasn't involved with policy work before joining with the National Farmers Union and Michigan Farmers Union. And so, you know, being able to get that exposure and not only just, you know, go and talk to your Congress member and representatives, but also seeing the other farmers out there that are also representing. And so feeling more like you're, you know, a part of a movement and being a part of like-minded people and like-valued people who are really passionate about policy work and really doing advocacy for farmers. Like, that's what's really motivating, seeing other farmers out there and then bringing that back home and keeping that work going and, you know, keeping that cycle going to convention, your local meetings and such. You know, it's being able to be a part of fly-ins and just be a part of the movement is really, really motivating and beautiful.
That's really lovely. I think it is really cool that NFU brings the farmers to DC to talk with the representatives instead of having all of these abstract kind of stories without names or without faces. Like, having those people there in person, I'm sure, makes a world of difference when you could, you know, they could be doing anything else, but they're there in DC, and it's great that we have the opportunity to bring folks like Akello and Raimonda out to DC to share their stories and talk about what their needs are.
And it's not just to deliver, a message. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, it's about making a connection too, so that it starts a conversation, continues the discussion between the elected official and the constituent, or between the staffer and the farmer. That way, those folks on Capitol Hill have a direct line to a family farmer in their district who has an idea, has a viewpoint on a lot of things. And that's really valuable when we can make those sorts of ties. And I think over the last couple of years here with National Farmers Union, one spot where we've emphasized that is through our advocacy training program, where we have brought in, I guess now, a couple dozen farmers from around the country who perhaps haven't been part of other fly-ins or other state-level policy activities, and give them some training and some confidence and some experience on how to make those connections. And it's starting to pay off. And it's always exciting to see that connection between the elected officials and their staff and farmers union members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, establishing that relationship with your representative, which is probably what it's supposed to be all about.
And it works. It definitely works. I must say this before we move on, because I would not have had these connections if not brought to the fly-in with the Senator Stabenow's office, who's like huge on ag policy. So to have those direct contacts with not only her staff, but the congressional staff of the district as well, to get that real-time feedback on our policy changes or on our insight on what we see on the as the boots on the ground, so to speak, changing in real time, is I think exactly what it's always supposed to be about. So kudos to you all again for providing that avenue for us.
Thank you. Are there any misconceptions on advocacy work or lobbying that you would like to clarify or eliminate?
I think a lot of what was just shared sort of did a bunch of that demystifying, because sometimes I think people treat lobbying as a dirty word. They think maybe it's all about tough negotiations or all about money or winning arguments, but it's much more about building relationships. It's about, and it's also about education. So I think that's a common misconception.
Great. All righty. So let's transition over to our questions for Akello and Raimondo. Can you share your farming stories with us and also tell us how Keep Growing Detroit has been part of your story in the urban growing field?
I'll go first, because unlike, you know, Akello's kind of been the guy that was groomed as a kid for agriculture, you know what I mean? And that is not my, it's not my story. So the way I actually got a degree in medical technology before I even like started developing a farm ever, which as a kid, I always thought was my career of choice. And once I started doing it, it just really was like unfulfilling to just be in a like hospital basement for hours on end, like with, you know, maybe two other engineers down there with me, and we're just under fluorescent lights for 12 hours.
All the fluorescent lights. It's the worst.
And so it definitely, I quickly realized that, you know, I had kind of lied to myself as a young kid, thinking like, okay, this is what I want to do, until I was doing it. And then it's like, okay, like, this isn't it for me. And a little bit after I realized that wasn't it, I started like wondering what it would be. So for a minute, I thought it would be, because I'm very handy, I thought it would be like I'd be some like master carpenter or whatever, like some architect or whatever. And so I learned under a licensed contractor for about 2 years. And while I was working with the contractor, you know, he kind of like sent me on a quest, like a samurai quest, where he like punished me for a year and like made me do all type of stuff I was like terrified of, like building a roof. And like, granted, like he didn't send me like on a mission where I would like really damage myself or injure myself, but it's like coming from a person like who's never built a roof, like to start like putting on OSB or start reframing raptors. It's like, this is scary stuff because, you know, and I remember actually in the quest, there was this moment where I was building the roof and he was like, okay, now walk over those raptors. And I'm like, what? Like, I'm not about to walk over the raptors, guy. He's like, well, if you can't, if you're scared to really walk on your work, then that says you're not confident in what you're doing, you know? And so, you know, just, you know, through trial and error kind of guided me through what it was like to live that type of lifestyle. And while I was doing the quest, I kept hearing this calling to like teach and feed kids. And I had no gardening experience like ever. You know what I mean? Like neither one of my grandparents had a garden. Like literally my dad's like the ultimate carnivore. Like give me chicken and hamburgers all day. And so it's like, for me, it was really like, what? And after a year or so, I just, you know, YouTube University and a lot of damaging learning. YouTube is, it's such a blessing, but it's dangerous. It's a dangerous place to gather. Yeah, to gather info. You learn a lot of what not to do on YouTube.
It's a mixed bag. Yeah.
And so, you know, upon, you know, just going in that direction, I started a garden in my grandmother's backyard and kind of like expanded until she was like, okay, you can't plant anything else in my backyard. Like, seriously. And so like, okay, and this was right around the time where the Detroit, they were knocking down all the houses and the blight situation was happening. And so it was kind of like there was now open land becoming available next to the properties. And so I'm like, okay, well, maybe I'll just make a, you know, small community garden. And so I started on that. And then from there, I actually literally an organization called Greening of Detroit, like rode down my residency and was like, dude, what are you doing? And I was like, I don't know. I think I'm about to like start a community garden here. And they're like, what? Seriously? And they're like, oh, we think we got a job for you. And so on that interview for that job is where I met Tefura Rushton, who is now Detroit's first urban agriculture manager for the city of Detroit. And I also met one of my mentors, Marcellus Wheeler, who also owns an urban tree forestry business and an urban farm development consultation business. And through meeting those two folks, another quest began in agriculture. And it was like, wow. And once I like kind of got my feet in the door a little bit, I realized that this is, you know, my calling and what I should be doing with my life and taking my time to really pursue what that calling was in my head of teaching and feeding kids. And it has, you know, brought me to learning a lot in ag, just well-versed. I'm pretty well-rounded for someone who did not study ag for college, like on the policy end, on the farm development end, on the food production end, on the food safety end, on the marketing end, on the like food preservation. We can do this all day. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of ag is how diverse it is. And the career choices that you can have is like, dude, like it's ridiculous. And so I ended up taking an apprenticeship. Needless to say, I got hired there because it was like all meant to be. And so I got hired there. I worked as an apprentice for Greening for 2 years. And then 2016, I got promoted to a farm coordinator for what was then the Detroit Market Garden, which is now the KGD Farm. But I got promoted to the coordinator in 16, farm manager in 17. And then Greening of Detroit kind of like shut down their urban ag department in 2017, 2018. And I kind of went on a journey there to develop a property that I was rehabbing next to my farmland. Because, you know, I don't know if you all noticed, but Detroit has a lot of like vacant properties available that were beautiful properties, honestly, built 1920s, like beautiful material, beautiful lumber, like stuff they really don't make anymore. But instead of like having a push to rehab, we had a lot of homes destroyed, which, you know, opened up a lot of land inversely. And we were able to develop some of it. And the house, I worked on it for 2 years. and now we're moving in. But right after I purchased the house, I started looking for jobs that were ag related, because Greening offered me a job as a forestry conservationist. And although I love the Greening, you know, I just felt like that wasn't the role that I was chosen to play in terms of ag and my role in teaching and feeding the kids. So I chose to leave the org, and I started looking for other ag related jobs. And that's when I came across Keep Growing Detroit and their garden resource program, and joined. I think the first time I joined was in maybe 2018. I think I joined while I was still working at Greening, but I wasn't even really able to be in the program like I'd like. And then 2020 is when I started actually working for the organization, and I was able to dive into the program and really experience their network and their commitment to growing the program that is feeding a lot of folks throughout the city, led by Akello here, who does a great job of producing the bulk of the resources that are distributed to our members, our close to 2,300 members here in the city. So, yeah, that's a very long-winded short of the story of how I dove into ag and how I got to where I am now.
Thanks for sharing.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I like to call myself as being a part of the returning generation of farmers. I got my start growing food with my mom in her backyard garden. And coming up, my brothers and sisters would call me the Martha Stewart of the family. And I'm glad they don't call me that now, because Martha Stewart has a different meaning today. But growing up, I knew where my food came from. And even more importantly, I knew the work that was needed to produce food. But I didn't really have that much exposure career-wise to a lot of farming options out there. And take that in with combination of hearing you should be doctor, lawyer, and all as a impressionable high school student looking to figure out their life really quickly before you go out to college. And so I went out to go study pre-law as my choice of major. And after some college, I had came back home, and one of my community members, they had taken over a garden I used to work at part-time in high school. And they were running this program called the Food Warrior Program, teaching kids how to make good decisions food-wise, and then also teaching them gardening as well. And they knew that I had worked in that garden back then. And they were like, hey, we got this program and we want you to help us out, because we knew that you were taking care of this garden. And that was my first footstep into, well, not so much making a living in agriculture, but really being able to be in a position to teach kids how to grow food, to manage a garden, and then also just do, you know, the good work. And I kind of compare that story of coming back home and learning how to farm and getting back to the farm kind of to the adage story that you always hear about farmers. They leave the farm and go to the city and to find themselves. But for me, I had left the city and came back to farm, and I've been farming here, you know, ever since, and really built roots. And coming up through the program that I was working with, the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and their Food Warrior Program, that had led me to finding out about Keep Growing Detroit's Youth Apprentice Program. And at this time, I was 20, so me being a youth was a stretch, but I'm glad they allowed me to join that program. And that was 2015, and that program at that time was about 5 weeks long during the summer on their 1.3-acre farm, where they produced their transplants for the Garden Resource Program and produced food as well, and held educational events for the public. And Keep Growing Detroit, they really left having me on the farm, and they really wanted to, hire me on. But to do that, I needed to go do a quest, just like Raimundo. They had told me about the Michigan State's Organic Farmer Training Program, and that is a 9-month-long program that takes place on their 16-acre organic farm, and they have about 7 to 6 of that in production, and they have about 100 member CSA community supported agriculture weekly box that they do. And literally from the point of, taking agriculture seriously, or, being working in agriculture, opportunities literally started to open up for me. It seemed like, there were no doors being opened up for me, choosing, a path like pre-law, no offense, Mike, or such, but, it wasn't my thing, or at least it wasn't for me at that time, but choosing agriculture, the possibilities and the opportunities opened up. And so, went off to go do the MSU's program, and that finished in November 2016 on the 18th. And 10 days after working that job, I got employed by Keep Growing Detroit. And so we're approaching my anniversary soon of about 7 years with Keep Growing Detroit. And that's crazy because I was like 21 at that time. And so, when people ask me, oh, how long have you been, farming and such, literally for my most of my professional career and such, I've been with Keep Growing Detroit, and it's really helped me. And with that said, learning how to grow food and work on a production level, I always knew that, there was more to understand. There was more behind farming there, than just growing the food. There's the policy side, the community advocacy side, the educational side of it, just meeting people inside of grocery stores and talking to them about food. So there's so many different avenues and facets, and I didn't restrict myself to just staying on the farm. I made sure that I took opportunities to go out and learn about policy by joining with the National Farmers Union, because I knew that they had, those connections and such. And, that was the best decision I made in 2019. Hope my girlfriend's not listening to that. All right, but... That's okay. We're going to cut that
Many
one out.
Many good decisions in 2019.
Correct. Roll it back. Many good decisions were made in 2019. I'll tell where I made that joke. Anyway. But taking advantage of those opportunities and reaching out to, those organizations that I knew had, the experiences that I needed to gain. And I was doing, along with National Farmers Union and such, making sure that I went to conferences, meeting other farmers, wherever I went and such, and keeping a connection with them, because I feel the, farming, you can easily, just stay on your farm, but there's so much more motivation, so much more learning opportunities by just getting out there and, going different places. Luckily I had that opportunity within my job and how it's set up and such. But, just taking that effort to go out there and learn and experience and, kind of break the mold and, start talking to politicians, start talking to community members and, representing, Detroit urban agriculture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Can you guys share how the urban farm model has worked in your communities and experience? And what needs have you been able to meet? And what are still some outstanding needs that you're seeing in your communities?
I'll let you go first, Raimundo, and catch my breath.
Okay, I got it. Okay, so urban farming right now in our in the city of Detroit, and although I must say that this year, in particular, I've been to about 10 urban cities to view urban ag models, and I've been flying more than I've ever flown before, ever. Okay, so the Urban Ag model here is working very well. I have noticed that Detroit in particular has a lot of production focused urban farming, more as other states, i.e. Pennsylvania, i.e. Baltimore, i.e. New York, have urban ag spaces as well. Some of them are more production focused, but most are agrotourism, renewable energy, community like interactive focused. But I think that the model here in Detroit is off to a great start. I think the advantage that we have over a lot of other of those other cities is our availability of open space here and our network of farmers that are either coming here from other states, i.e. Wisconsin, Mike, to come and farm, or I've met a lot of farmers from all over the country that have came here with interest to buy land and farm. And I think what also separates us is the network of farmers that we have here. Definitely is closer than a lot of other states, I'd say. And that's a lot of that is due to the Keep Growing Detroit's GRP program. Not a lot of other states have a program in where farmers are meeting with each other frequently or often to have conversations about what issues that they're having or policy issues that they're running against, whether it's land acquisition, whether it's husbandry locally, or you know whatever you know the issue may be. Detroit is a rare space because we have a program with a network, and I often, you know, a lot of these the folks that are in the program aren't large scale farmers, but the few that are having those discussions about, you know, how was your tractor, how was your, you know, you know, how was your soil quality this year, how was your growing, how was your pest, blah 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 blah. So these conversations are had at a much more higher rate, although I will say that, you know, they're starting to become more of a model and an understanding. I think that those conversations between food producers are needed, and we actually got a chance to go to Iowa through the Beginner Farmer Institute this year to discuss a little bit of that. And there we had a presenter, and I'm blanking on his name right now. And the Iowa Farmers Union president was there as well. And they were speaking on how they are now doing like monthly or semi-monthly Zoom meets to literally do exactly that and have those discussions on what's going on. And so kudos to Farmers Union for opening those spaces on a national scale as well, for folks to discuss. But I think we're doing good here. I definitely see urban ag growing exponentially in the ongoing years. You know, hopefully Mike and Aaron can get us some more federal dollars to continue expanding. But honestly, you know, I think that there's going to be more of an appreciation for urban ag once the scale grows and the food production grows. Because right now it's like, oh, those, you know, you can't produce anything on your little 1 acre until we have 2,000 one acres. And now we're talking, you know what I'm saying? And so it's like, I think, you know, the more we continue to teach folks and develop new farmers and folks that are committed to producing locally, then I think we'll be okay.
I have some connections to it. Well, I'm gonna take us on a, you know, it's gonna be a little roundabout answer, but I think we will all appreciate it. And just kind of, you know, kind of to kind of contextualize it, or kind of what we're experiencing or such. If we look at about 100 years ago or such, and this is an oversimplification, you know, the majority of us were farming or growing food in some type of capacity. And as we look at today, you know, not that many people are growing food. There's more consolidation, there's more consumers and such. And then we take that and look at the issues that we're facing today, and really a lot of them just come from people being disconnected from their food or being disconnected from, you know, that work or not being able to see how that food is grown. And so when I'm teaching people or such about, you know, food or such, and even when I'm making connections to different, well, really, you know, interconnected issues, but issues that are treated differently from environmental issues or, you know, food sovereignty issues, it really just comes down to, you know, people are more disconnected from their food than they were ever before. And this only happened in such a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. And so coming from a farmer's perspective, and you know, I don't limit myself by just calling myself an urban farmer, you know, I'm going to grow food wherever I'm at. And that's really the attitude that a lot of people need to take, whether they're rural, suburban, or urban, or, you know, whatever's in between. Because when we start to, you know, treat it like such and, you know, demand the right to have, you know, the access and the resources to grow food where we are, you know, we're going to see a lot of our attention and the feelings and the energy towards these issues that we're facing today, you know, start to change. And, you know, that's important, doubly so for an urban setting, because when, well, to kind of back it up a little bit, I joined the National Farmers Union because I did come up from an urban farming background to really learn, you know, rural issues and, you know, get connected with rural farmers and such, because I just didn't have that access. And, but to also bridge that gap between rural farmers and urban farmers, because I've often heard, you know, what are urban farmers doing, similar to what Raimundo shared. But, you know, really, you know, we're all experiencing the same weather, experiencing the same challenges. You know, we're all out here trying to grow food for people and such. And, you know, taking that perspective from an urban farmer, you know, we might not have the land or such, but, you know, we have access to the people. And so that comes with a lot of responsibility, because we are in a position to educate people, to talk to people directly. Because, like, you know, if somebody's, you know, question like, hey, why is my, you know, food in the grocery store, you know, why does it cost so much? You know, aren't you a farmer here? You know, that's direct access that we have in order to help them understand the food system and help them take part in the food system. While also saying, hey, you could come in, you know, grow food with us in the community garden and get closer to these issues and start to do some advocacy on that side. And so, you know, having access to people, being in a position to educate folks is really where I see the role that urban agriculture plays within this, you know, big food system and such. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't call, you know, necessarily not having a lot of land access be a challenge, because, you know, the other side of that is that there's a lot of people here and such. And mm-hmm. if we, you know, get those people growing food, get them, you know, participating in community gardens or backyard gardens, or, you know, even growing food inside their house, you know, we could see a huge shift in, you know, momentum and, you know, get a lot more people, you know, mm-hmm. although they might not be necessarily, you know, the quintessential farmer, you know, they could still join the farmers union, you know? Mm-hmm.
Let me piggyback off you real quick. So look, also on top of the point you just made about us having a strong network and the connections of residents that we have here, there's also a niche in developing new farmers, and there's a need for this niche as well here. And as we develop new farmers, and I think, Akello, you and I both have grown in our understanding that there's a need for more rural farmers, because the average age of a rural farmer is like high 60s or somewhere in the 60s, I believe it is. And, you know, as those folks are continuously passing down that land, there becomes a lot of loss in interest of farming. And so I think that's where we could also see a spike in urban farmers that go rural, so to speak. And really, and kind of like you touched on, Akello, I myself, I joined the National Farmers Union in 2021, and I joined because I was like at the point in my quest where now my mentor is like, okay, like you've got like urban, and even in my own experience, I'm like, okay, urban is starting to look very small to me now, because I managed the Detroit Market Garden, which is now the Keep Growing Detroit Farm, and that was a little bit over 2 acres. And so it's like, okay, I understand acreage, I understand how to handle and manage acreage, and now it's just really scaling up from there. And so I was at the point in my quest where now my mentor is like, okay, we're going to rent you the John Deere tractor for a month. And, you know, I'm also part of a cooperative that does urban farming to rural farming training. And so now they're telling me like, okay, you need to go get 70 hours on the tractor this week and learn how to form beds and hook up the 3-point PTO. And if a hydraulic hose busts, what are you going to do? And how do you manage these type of things on a large scale operation? Where in the urban setting, we don't really have those issues because we're using a walk behind tiller, or, you know, the equipment is just a lot smaller scale. I mean, sometimes, you know, we can use the bigger scale, but for the majority of the urban farmers, they're using small scale equipment that don't, you know, have those issues, or they don't, you know, need or want the experience or have the capacity to, you know, develop or handle heavy equipment. So, yeah, I just wanted to make that point about that as well.
Thanks, Armando. I was able to remember. What I wanted to kind of highlight, just the difference within the possibilities within urban, some of the possibilities and also some of the challenges within urban settings. So coming up here in Detroit, we, you know, me and Armando have been able to help establish a garden research program that supports 2,200, and we were just looking up the numbers today, 2,229 gardens. And those are ranging from family gardens, market gardens, school gardens, all shapes and sizes and such. And so Armando mentioned that we've been doing a lot of traveling this year, both of us. But when I go to different, you know, particularly urban settings in different states and such, you know, I go and see, you know, can we, you know, implement, you know, the garden research program here to help people get food access, to help them start growing food and help assisting them within their own farming goals. And, you know, there are unique challenges with New York City, for example. You know, there's not that much land, a lot of buildings and such. San Francisco, and these are places that I've visited and really looked in depth at. San Francisco, you know, it has its own challenges, a lot more land access and such, but mm-hmm. You know, still some space constraints. And, you know, through all the challenges that Detroit has had, you know, we're in a unique position because there is that land access. There are those, you know, those vacant lots which people are reclaiming and turning into gardens and starting to produce food and get the community involved. And, you know, ultimately becoming farmers and stewards of the land. And so, yeah, that's that point. I kind of wanted to bring in the national team because Armando brought in a point about the farm bill and how, you know, farmers are getting older and older. I think our average age is somewhere around 69. You know, within the farm bill, it being, and this is kind of a two-part question here, within the farm bill being pushed back till next year, you know, what, you know, possibilities or challenges does that bring up? And to get to the point about the aging farmer, you know, those are a bunch of baby boomers, and we're looking at, you know, in 10 years or so, what does that land transition look like? You know, that's a possibility for more concentration to happen, or a possibility for more land to be shared amongst the people and get more, you know, new and beginning farmers, because the biggest challenge for us is land access, you know, possibilities. So, you know, what are my GR team members thinking?
The delay in the farm bill isn't doing anybody any favors, that's for sure. We need to get this taken care of. We need to get the farm bill passed, but not just any farm bill. We need the right farm bill. And this farm bill should make sure to address the issues of land transition, whether that's through the lens of the aging farm population, where the average age of a farmer continues to grow, to increase these days. And also with the concerns about how the next generation of farmers gets involved in agriculture. Hard to do that without access to land, either through ownership or a reasonable way to lease or work some other land. So that transition is going to be a big one when we go from one generation to the next. And the Farm Bill offers an opportunity for policymakers to emphasize programs that help connect exiting farmers with those getting into the business, whether it's making sure that farmers who are just getting started have access to programs, know how to get access to those programs, and have some, you know, rather favorable starting points on them so that they can have a way to get their feet under them as they get into production ag. But if we keep waiting on the farm bill and having to wait for a farm bill, that's not helping. We need to make progress, not just stand by at the status quo. That's a great question, Akella.
Just keeping you all on your toes. Yeah.
And then, Catherine, to your point about, like, so I do own one of these small farms here that is in the GRP, and I operate it. This year was the first year we hired staff. Which was why I was able to fly around and not lose all my crops. But it's been quite the journey. I think, you know, having a producing farm here in my hometown is amazing. And I think that we have a lot of work to do on our policy, on our ordinancing, which I'm very excited to work with Tefira on advocating and being a fly on her wall. And as she writes our ordinances and our regulations here for the city. But I will say that nationally, I think that urban ag is definitely on the move. I see a lot of USDA grants around urban ag focus now, which is great. I see a lot of interest in operations like mine that are very committed to producing local food for consumers, whether it be youth or adults, or your farmer's market or whatever, grocery stores or whatever. And I think that that interest will continue to grow. And I think that that appreciation for local food will also continue to grow. And I think that organizations like mine and Keep Growing Detroit, who are really spearheading, introducing what local produce means to not only kids, but to families as well, and the impact that it really has, really touched on the point that Akello made earlier about how people are just literally disconnected from what's on their plate. And y'all should see when I go to some of these schools and the kids are like, the carrot come from the ground? And I'm like, nope, you've never seen a Looney Tune? Like, come on. Like, you know,
yeah.
You know, like these are things that you should know. Like, but we it's true.
Right.
Like, it's a complete disconnect that has grown over the last few years. And so I think that Urban Ag definitely could be one of the expressways to get folks back to understanding, like, what you're eating.
Mm-hmm. And they don't really teach about food in school. For a time, I was teaching after school cooking classes. And similarly, I would encounter kids, and I would make like little quizzes just to kind of test their knowledge and see what I was dealing with. But Like, they don't know about seasonality, or like, especially when you can go to the grocery store and a tomato is there all year round. How are you supposed to know when it's truly in season? So Definitely a lot of room for increased education. And also, I think it's so empowering for people to be able to make food if they want to, you know, and have, you know, your hands in the ground and the soil. And it's very, you know, rewarding in so many ways.
Yeah.
I want to open up the floor more, or continue to open up the floor to discussion, if you have any questions for each other.
Ether and I do want to piggyback on your comment, you know, about, you know, more people getting engaged in growing food and such. You know, with that, you know, growing food, there is a responsibility there as well. You know, as food producers, you know, mm-hmm. we are directly, you know, as food producers, we are, you know, in charge of the food safety. You know, that needs to be taken in consideration mm-hmm. as well. So, it, you know, although it's, you know, super great to pull a carrot out the ground and just start eating it, you know, you gotta make sure that you, you know, not rinse, but wash that.
Food safety.
I'm guilty of it, but.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, we have to take that that importance with it.
No, I'm with you, Kello. I love to eat stuff. Like, yeah, it's nothing like it. Especially, like, not growing up having that privilege. It's like, you know, I was talking to my kids about that, Catherine, to your point of, like, making things, right? So, like, my daughter knows how to make, you know, her own mm-hmm. avocado, tomato sauce. Like, these are things, like, I did not have the privilege of being able to know. Mm-hmm. So, in one generation, so... I can only imagine, you know, the impact that, as Urban Ag continues to develop, the mm-hmm. impact that it'll have on these little kids around here and their understanding on their food safety.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another connection there is, you know, if people were, you know, more closely related to their food, you know, being out there in the soil, having to harvest out their food, you know, you got to wash that if you've ever harvested a carrot. You know, when you're in the grocery store, you're like, oh, it's already clean. You know, I need to do all that. You know, there's so many disconnects that just happen when, you know, your food is being primarily taken care of by other people. And so you got to reclaim, you know, a lot of those basics, really. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about just growing food, you know, it's not revolutionary. Growing your own food is not revolutionary. Mm-hmm. It is the basics. And so... Yeah, mm-hmm. that's what people've gotten away from, and we just need to, you know, take it back a little bit mm-hmm. and, you know, slow it down some.
Right.
I got a question for Mike or Aaron. You know, and this is just me growing in my understanding, so apologize my ignorance if I ask something crazy, right? But so,
sure.
In my understanding, from my research that I've done, a lot of big organizations that are lobbying with you all, or not with you all, I should say, but alongside of you all in the same spaces, probably not with the same intent or the same goals in mind. But how do you all navigate that avenue as you advocate for the little guy, quote unquote, in a room where there's big pharma, where there's McDonald's, where there's, you know, all of these high-paying interests, I'm sure, that really want to take the food policy and farm bill the opposite way that we do, you know?
Mm-hmm. One thing that we try to do is play to our strengths. You know, if we try to take on the meat packers at their own game, are not going to win. You know, they're a lot bigger. They have a lot more resources. They have a lot of those, you know, if we tried to go toe to toe, dollar for dollar with them, no, it's not going to work. What we do have that they don't have is people power. And we have constituents who are members who have a clear story and a clear voice and are willing to speak up about it. So that's on the grassroots advocacy side of things. For us who are working in it day to day in Washington, yeah, that can be pretty strange sometimes to be working in coalitions maybe not with the meat packers, but with other groups that certainly aren't on the same mindset and worldview as we are. But strategically, it makes sense sometimes to work with those who maybe share a common interest, a common enemy sometimes, even if we don't totally align or even get close to aligning ideologically or as in viewpoints. And that's kind of the strategic approach we need to take, even when we work with big coalitions sometimes that involve lots of other viewpoints that we probably disagree with sometimes, but maybe at the issue at hand, we can get on board. On a similar note, sometimes the trickiest alliances to work with are those with people who we see pretty closely with, but not exactly with. Aaron and I were just talking about something along these lines earlier today, where sometimes the trickiest parts are working with your friends and how to best leverage that and how to make sure we're lifting up our friends as well as Farmers Union members' voices and making sure that we can keep the peace while being productive is always a balance.
Thanks for that, Mike. I appreciate that answer.
Great answers, Mike. And a really good question, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, real good question.
Do you, Aaron or Mike, have any questions for Akello and Raimondo?
One aspect is on, you know, we talk about regulations sometimes. And I just got back from an event where a lot of farm broadcasters had gathered up, and a lot of the questions centered around, what are you doing to fight back against onerous regulations? Which I always think is a little interesting, because it's sometimes there's a good reason for, most of the time there's some good reasons for rules being in place and that sort of thing. But on food safety, I guess, is one spot. I was curious for both of you on how that, you know, Food Safety Modernization Act and other issues affects your operation, what you're doing about that, and how that plays out. Maybe one instance of how that's played out recently for you or for your neighbors and friends.
It's presented us with opportunities to educate people, Mike, more so than anything. Not so much a lot of challenges, because one of the things we have to say is like, hey, you know, the recall that happened to your iceberg lettuce, that happened at the grocery store. You know, that happened over there. This is the farmer's market. It didn't happen here. You know, this is food grown locally. You know, this isn't a mass produced. This is, you know, artisan grown food, you know, with care and attention. But, you know, beyond, you know, having that ability to have conversations with people at farmers markets, which produces, you know, a lot of opportunity to have that engagement and be that, you know, that voice for people directly, we also open up our farm to teach, you know, farm food safety along with our other classes as well. We, you know, show them our wash pack. We show them the different steps and practices, different types of, you know, disinfectants and cleaners they can use. Not just, you know, on their, you know, materials and such, but, you know, disinfectants that are good to be mixed in with water and such for your food. And so treating it like it's the opportunity, you know, to, you know, because people are paying attention more to their food. That's, you know, one of the results of when you get this type of attention and people, and I'll say also governments as well. You know, that's how the rural crackdowns came down. You know, they needed to finally do something and have some standards around food regulations and such. I'd say it's a good thing. And the way that they're doling it out, you know, they're giving farmers time to, you know, come into regulation. And then they're also treating it as a scale. So, you know, based on like the amount of money or such that you're, you know, making off of your farm, you know, and this year you'll have to, you know, fall into the rules and such. I'm sure the Farm Food Safety team is familiar with the scale and how that all that flows. But, you know, it's giving farmers opportunity to educate folks and then also differentiate their food. You know, when you have that connection to your farmer, you can ask them what you're doing and how you're doing it. And then that's an opportunity for people to learn and take that practice and do it for themselves as well as the food that they purchase from you.
Yep. To piggyback off you, Akello, from my perspective, my personal experience, I've been doing a lot of farm to school, like I was telling you all. And so we do have a lot of food safety work that we do. And we also do a lot of working with the KGDs of the world in advocating and working with partners like Michigan State to develop programs to sustain the push for food safety as we grow farmers and more producers here, like a Scrubs program that I was able to be a part of this year, where I was awarded like a small wash pack area for my farm. And then on the other end of that spectrum, we have the folks that are interested in becoming more heavily involved or expanding their production. And now they have a few go-to farms to establish the understanding of what that true scale looks like from when you want to serve a school on a food safety scale, and what that actually looks like, where before that really wasn't a model that we had locally. We would have to drive to Utica or wherever to understand what that looked like and how that process works.
And I can piggyback on all this a little bit, if you'd like, on the food safety front. This is really good information about how this is looked on the ground, and I can sort of tie it to advocacy too. So let's see if I can find the right jumping off point. Maybe I'll just start with this. It's really helpful to hear sort of the direct impact of FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act, on the ground for urban agriculture, and to be reminded that it does have an impact, good, bad, and otherwise. The foundation of National Farmers Union's food safety advocacy and work and policy is that we strongly support, and our members strongly support, securing a safe food supply. And I really heard that in Armando's and Akello's responses, that food safety is important, making sure, regardless of scale, that you're producing safe food is important. But our policy also recognizes that we cannot have, and our members have made clear, that we can't have a one-size-fits-all approach to food safety. And going back to when FSMA was being developed, I think there was a recognition that this was a big challenge, that of course everyone agreed we needed to make improvements and secure a more safe food supply. But how do we do that that allows all scales of production and types of production to flourish? And it actually became a big part of the debate. There was the Tester-Hagen Amendment. I was referring to Senator Tester of Montana and Hagen of North Carolina. And that amendment passed, and basically it said that there would be some changes to the way FSMA was written to ensure smaller scale and direct-to-market producers were in some ways exempt from aspects of regulation, but not from ensuring food is safe. So, you know, to be clear, all food producers or all farmers need to produce safe food. It came down more to the nitty-gritty of how you would get there. So NFU, once FSMA was passed, and FDA, the Food and Drug Administration that administers FSMA, got down to actually writing the nitty-gritty rules of how this would all work. You know, this is when that grassroots advocacy also sprang into action, not just making sure we passed the right law, but then providing that direct feedback from our members to FDA about how we implement this thing and write the rules and make that work. We've written lots of different comments to FDA and engaged directly to help FDA understand what our members need to implement FSMA in a way that's actually going to work. And FDA has been very responsive in many respects. It is a complicated law, and complicated regulations are also written And that's a big reason why the food safety work at National Farmers Union exists today. That is also partially a product of the advocacy work of our members over the years who said to lawmakers, hey, we really want to do a good job implementing FSMA. We really want to help be part of ensuring we have a safe food supply. But we can't do that without adequate technical assistance and without building capacity to implement that law well. And that's a big part of what the Food Safety Collaborative is in the food safety work at NFU, as I understand it. Actually, back in 2015, we had worked with a group of members of Congress to write FDA and say, hey, you know, we need FDA to step up. We're 5 years in past the law being passed and rules are being written. And we're hearing from our members, from Farmers Union members and some other stakeholder groups, we're hearing from their members too, saying, this is really tricky, complicated law. We need support for technical assistance. And we really want to get this right. And a lot of that played a role in what we see here today and even this conversation that we're having. So that's just a little bit about how impactful advocacy is and bringing that grassroots voice to federal agencies and to lawmakers. And in this case, around food safety.
Thanks for sharing that, Aaron. I feel like that is some really good history that, you know, just shedding some light on why we're doing the work and how we got here today. And it's great to connect with people on both ends and say, how is it working on the ground? How is it working on the policy front? And I think that's kind of what we're all trying to get after. You know, of course, we want healthy food and safe food for people, but I feel like a lot of this conversation has been about getting back to the roots. If that is grassroots advocacy, if that's getting back to the root of community health through reclaiming land and farming on it, there's so much there. And so I guess my final question for you all is, what advice would you give to farmers who have yet to get into advocacy work? Would you say you should do it by yourself? Would you say you should join NFU and join as a group? What would be your advice for people that maybe are hesitant or don't know where to start?
I would definitely, first off, you know, have folks research on policies that affect and fit their situation, their growing. And, you know, that could be, you know, we talked about YouTube University earlier. That can be dangerous. So I would say that it helps to have a network like Farmers Union to have multiple avenues just to fact check and double check all of the readings and changes in policy, because they do change very frequently. That you know, and kind of get like a heads up on the temperature of the room, so to speak, and how things are looking. That's what I would advise folks.
I'd say my a good advice is to you know, find your local farmers union and get involved with them. They've been doing it for a long time.
You know, shout out.
They know what they're doing. And, you know, get connected that way. I would say they, you know, likely have a connection to your state senators and state representatives, and also your, you know, federal representatives as well. So there is the, you know, there's always that ability to, you know, go ahead and find out that new information yourself. But, you know, a strength is also reutilizing the resources that are already there.
What about once people join Farmers Union? Mike, Aaron, what would your advice be?
When you join Farmers Union, you've got access to a whole bunch more resources and expertise. And most of all, you can share the story that you have experienced yourself, but it's amplified because there's hundreds, thousands of other farmers across the country who likely have experienced something similar to what you've gone through already. If it's a problem, or if it's an idea you have, bring it forward in the grassroots policy process and help steward that through the different layers and levels so that we can help make a change here in DC or in Lansing or wherever you are in the country.
Anywhere in between. Aaron, do you have any final words of wisdom or advice?
I can't top that. It's so good. I want to leave it there.
I got a little something to share. This does not have to go on the podcast. it's a terrible preference. But to kind of share some perspective, I'd say this is just a conversation with our next gen advisory board member, Josh Manschke. I'm sure you are familiar with him and his golfing background and such. So he's been on a couple of travels and all, been international. And so I asked him, because I've known some people who do a lot of international travel, like, you know, how do you deal with that food poisoning? Because it just happens when you're out there. And so got a big crack out of him, and he shared this story about him being in India, you know, playing out there, and one of his friends that he was with, who's from India, he asked his friend the exact same thing, where his friend asked him or told him, like, American food is too clean. That's why you have a problem with your with people getting sick from food all the time. It's just too clean. And so, you know, take pride. You know, take pride. Our food is clean. You know, we're doing good. We're doing good. Okay.
I think the next time we write comments to the FDA, that's what I'm going to say. Actually, it's too clean.
You're doing too good of a job.
How's that? I don't know if that's going to go over so well. It's a little inconsistent with our policy.
I like it. I'm with you there.
Well, thanks for ending us on a food safety note,
Akela. It's a good one.
Well, thanks so much, everybody, for contributing your voices and experiences to this conversation. I feel like my perspectives were definitely broadened by this, and hopefully everybody else too a little bit. This has been really lovely.
Thank you so much for organizing, Catherine. Really appreciate it. Billy and Haley.
Yeah, for sure. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the platform. Thank you all.
Happy to do it.
The Local Food Safety Collaborative is a cooperative initiative established between the National Farmers Union Foundation and the Food and Drug Administration with the goal of providing training, education, and technical assistance to local food producers to ensure good food safety practices and compliance with the Food Safety Modernization Act. National Farmers Union is a grassroots, farmer-driven organization that believes strong family agriculture is the basis for thriving communities. NFU's membership includes over 230,000 family farmers and ranchers across America. Farmers Union's grassroots structure promotes locally initiated policy priorities and educational topics established by their members. Learn more about National Farmers Union at www.nfu.org. And finally, thank you to our sponsor. This podcast is supported by the Food and Drug Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as a part of a financial assistance award 2U01FD006921-04, totaling $1 million with 100% funding by FDA-HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by FDA-HHS or the U.S. government. I'm Catherine Kavanaugh, and this is the Food Safety Dish. Until next time.